Hi, I'm Mickey Lowe.
Hi, I'm Bishop Todd. And welcome to the C4SO podcast.
Well, hey, Bishop Todd, it's great to see you.
Yeah, so obviously you and Travis and your baby made it home safe.
Yes. For our listeners, we came back from our clergy conference, which happened a couple weeks ago, and it was just this wonderful time. It was like a reunion, just getting to see all of our clergy brothers and sisters, and getting to hang out with you, Bishop Todd, was so fun. After it ended, there's like kind of this lingering sadness of like, man, when am I going to see them again?
I know. We're all so spread apart. Yeah. So I know you know proper food, Mickey, and so does Travis. So you guys had to be impressed with those fish tacos from Patrick.
Oh, man. So we're actually not fish people, but we tried it. And because Patrick talked it up a lot, you know, he was really proud of it. So we're like, we got to do it.
Good thing we had chicken there for you and Travis.
Yeah, no, but we did have the fish and it was in fact delicious.
Wow. Good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not like, it's never our first choice, but we were it's like really high.
And I think fish tacos are a bigger deal in California than in Florida. Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, people eat it here. It's just, I don't know. It's just really not our thing. But we were very, very impressed. So
I know.
And it was very hyped up. So we had
to do
it.
That was a fun night.
Yeah. Everybody else was doing it, so we had to do it too. But yeah, that was just a really sweet time with our clergy. And now we are back today with back at work. We are back to regularly scheduled events. So today we get the chance to sit down with Sabrina S. Chan, who is the National Director of Asian American Ministries for InterVarsity here in the U.S. And we speak to her about this book, Learning Our Names, Asian American Christians on Identity, Relationships, and Vocation, that she was a contributor to. And we just really get to hear her story as a Chinese American Christian. And it's just a really wonderful, vulnerable conversation, just getting to hear about her and her experience and what a gift that Asian American Christians are to the church and what we can learn from them.
Yeah, her vulnerability, and you can tell there's a point where we're asking her questions that they're not just cognitive for her. They're really, to use a big word, existential, you know, they're like in her bones.
Right.
And I'm always so impressed and grateful when people of color are answering those difficult questions, because it helps me as an old white guy to see what I think is an important simultaneity. That racism and racializing things is really real. But it's also really subtle and complex and deep. And without these conversations and without the vulnerability of our friends who are people of color, we don't really get a full understanding of what's going on. And I'm always really impressed and grateful when I get to talk to somebody like Sabrina.
Yes, we are so grateful for her time. We're so grateful for her wisdom. And we are so excited to share this episode with her today. So without further ado, please enjoy this episode with Sabrina S. Chan. Sabrina, thank you so much for joining us today. We're so excited to have you.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
So we like to start off our conversations with maybe some behind the scenes information on kind of who you are and give our listeners a chance to just get to know you a little bit. So what is your favorite fun talent that maybe most people would not know about you?
Yeah. One thing that I think, you know, most people that if they aren't friends or whatever wouldn't know is that I unicycle.
That's unicycle. One of the best we've ever heard, right, Mickey?
Wow.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
I don't unicycle regularly anymore, but when my husband and I met, when we were dating, he had put on his dating profile, we met online, he had put on his dating profile that he was a unicyclist. And I was like,
wow,
what is this? And so one of our early dates, and I was a cyclist, so we went on a ride, and he was like, is it okay if I bring my unicycle? And I was like, yeah, that'd be great. And he does all kinds of unicycling, so mountain unicycling.
Oh my gosh, never even heard of it.
Unicycle basketball, you know, all kinds of stuff. And I, you know, got to know him and some of his unicyclist friends, and I thought, you know, that looks like it could be fun to try. And, you know, some of his friends weren't that athletic, and so I thought, if they can do it, I should be able to learn how to do this too.
Yeah.
And I thought it'd be a good dating sort of thing to try.
Yeah, totally.
Like, can I learn something that I'm not going to be good at first? And can he teach me? And will I get mad? And
how
to resolve conflict? All that stuff. So
Gosh.
They say it takes about 12 to 15 hours to learn to unicycle. Anybody, you know,
can
learn to learn. But the trick is, I think I could only really practice for like 30 to 40 minutes at a time, because it uses these muscles that I hadn't, these core balancing muscles that I don't use very often. So,
Oh my gosh.
But it's fun. It feels a little bit like flying because you're not holding on to anything.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask if like it was scary at first, or if it like, because you don't have handlebars or anything.
Yeah. You usually start to learn like on a fence, like next to it, like a tennis court's a good spot because it's really flat and there's a fence that you can hold on to and leverage hold somebody's hand or like, you know, hold their shoulder as you're learning. But
oh my gosh, Sabrina, I think you win the prize of the best hidden talent of anybody we've ever interviewed.
It's amazing.
I haven't done it in a little bit, but we hope to teach the kids and
that's great.
It's so fun. Oh man, well thanks for sharing that, Sabrina. We are so excited to learn from you, and we're so excited to hear more about your story, and we're going to talk about the book that you contributed to along with a few other people, Learning Our Names: Asian American Christians on Identity, Relationships, and Vocation. As Bishop Todd and I were prepping for this, we were just so excited and have this eagerness to learn about your Asian American heritage and especially the contributions to the gospel. So we just wanted to begin by letting our listeners hear your story. And that's kind of broad, but it could be your faith, your parents' journey. I mean, you are a second generation Asian American. So just wherever you'd like to start, we would just love to hear your story.
Yeah, thanks for letting me share a bit. My family is from Southern China. So generations and generations back, my in Southern China, my parents and their families immigrated to Hong Kong, you know, a ways back. And then they came to the States for graduate school post 1965, when the immigration was allowed for sort of more educated Asians to come and immigrate. So they emigrated in that wave, came to faith in graduate school as a part of a Bible study for Chinese folks overseas. And yeah, I grew up in the church. I grew up in a almost entirely white church. There's was one Nigerian family that came for about a year. And that was up till about high school, when my dad felt called to help minister in the Chinese church also in our hometown. And so then we went to both churches, the white church on Sunday morning, Sunday evening, the Chinese church on Sunday morning. They didn't have an evening service. And then Wednesday night youth group was at the white church, and Friday night youth group was at the Chinese church.
Oh, wow.
It was a lot of church.
Yeah.
Sounds like it.
Possibly too much church. I walked away from the faith in late high school. I mean, I was physically present, right, at services, but a lot of my heart was not there. And going to college just was a time to explore and do my own thing. I was trying to, I think in some ways, run away from the faith, run away, you know, try to get as far away from home as I could.
Yeah.
That was, ended up being in Texas, at Rice University. Through some different things, came back to the faith, between freshman and sophomore year, and got involved with InterVarsity at that point, as a student. And that was a place that God really, used to grow me spiritually. And also with that, I think in my understanding of my own identity as a Chinese American and as an Asian American, I think growing up where I did and in the context I did, there was a lot of racism that I internalized. And, you know, I would have, you know, when I was in college, I didn't want to join any Asian student organizations. I tried to stay away in a sense, partly out of this, I don't want to be identified. I don't want to be seen as other, because growing up, to be seen as accepted was to be more white. So it was actually through InterVarsity and ministry there, through a book called Following Jesus Without Dishonoring Your Parents that was published in 1998, I think, by IVP that really started me in some ways on that journey. And I was an engineer. I was an engineer for a couple of years, came on staff with InterVarsity at a large Asian American fellowship there in Austin. And yeah, so staff there, was a area director. And then I felt a sense of desire to move to California, to the Bay Area for another area director position, it was a good place to finish my seminary degree at Fuller up there. And then I ended up meeting my husband, I think I mentioned him earlier, up there. And, and so I continued in ministry leadership. About 5 years ago, this position came open as national director for Asian American Ministries for InterVarsity. And so, been doing that. And then we moved back to the East Coast to be closer to family.
Tell us just a couple of stories of your Asian or Asian American heroes, and why are they important to you, and why have they influenced you?
That's an interesting question. Like, I think thinking about that question, I think one person that comes to mind is my grandma, my dad's mom. And I think I write about this. I think I told this story in the book, but she, you know, didn't have an easy life. Like, was farming, rice farmer, you know, and took my dad to the fields and those kinds of things. And then took her family out of China when there was a big famine and fled to Hong Kong. And I think whenever I'm having to do a hard thing, I think about her.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
I didn't have much of a relationship with her in some ways because, you know, ocean and language barrier and all those things. And she died when I was in high school. But I think about her. I think about, you know, there's different ministers, Asian American InterVarsity ministers that have been important to me, both as mentors, but also like leading out in ministry, you know, Paul Tokunaga and Jeanette Yap and Lisa Espinelli Chin, I think, who have just are doing the long haul of ministry, you know, over many years. And when there are very, very, very few Asian American ministers. I also think about folks like Fred Korematsu or Grace Lee Boggs, who are more on the activist, right? Fred Korematsu fought against Japanese American incarceration. And Grace Lee Boggs was a civil rights activist in Michigan, in Detroit, married to James Boggs. And just, she's Chinese American and just really lived into some of these things. And then, you know, I think hero's probably too strong, just because it's just fun, though, right? Like, I grew up as a kid, we'd occasionally get to see Hong Kong movies. You know, somebody would have it burned on a laser disc or something. At somebody's house, we'd maybe get to see a Michelle Yeoh movie. And then, you know, so seeing her in different movies over the years. And then more recently, you know, to be winning awards and finally being more recognized. That's pretty fun.
Yeah, that's fun.
You know, just even not too long ago, seeing her on Star Trek. I think Star Trek Discovery, is that the one where she got to play a captain? I was like, oh my gosh, this is something cool.
Thanks, Sabrina, for letting us hear a bit of that. Let's turn our attention now to your book. As Mickey said, Learning Our Names, Asian American Christians on Identity, Relationships, and Vocation. So we always know that, you know, authors have something they want to say. That's why they're writing it. But I also know enough authors to know that they're not just trying to say something, that they typically hope their book will do something. What were you and your co-authors hoping this book would do that would be like a practical outcome?
Yeah, that's great. I love that, what you're saying. I hope it says something, but you're hoping it does something. When I took this role, one of the first things I did was talk to Al Shi at IVP. He's an editor at IVP and said, hey, is it time for another book? Because the Following Jesus Without Dishonoring Your Parents was really important for me as a college student, but you know, it had been 20 years. And I thought, I think I'd love to, one, show more of the diversity of Asian America. So that first book was written by an all East Asian group of authors. And, you know, Asian America is much more diverse than that, and wanted to share more stories from more different communities. And then also just felt like, you know, race is a social construct, right? But we have to deal with the implications of race. And because it's a social construct, it does change, right? And so it just felt like, oh, it's been 20 years. There's probably things that have shifted, and we want to write for today. And our hope really was to help Asian American Christians discern what it means to follow Jesus in this time and place, and from their, you know, social location, right? So, like, you know, every generation of believers from wherever they are and in whatever status or place has had to discern that, right? And wanting to make space for for us, for young people to maybe see themselves. We're not trying to necessarily like prescribe, like here's what you need to do, mm-hmm. but more give examples and describe what we've seen and the dedication says, you know, to it's something like, for future generations, we hope you'll rewrite this when it's time. Just to say like, hey, yeah, I hope this helps inspire conversation and a thought. And I hope, you know, down the road, others will write more on these topics, you know, just trying to open those doors and see that following Jesus incorporates all of who we are, not just like, and it's not a colorblind thing, I guess, is what maybe how I'd put it too.
I was really moved by this book, and I really enjoyed your introduction to the book. I am not from Asian American heritage, but I am from Latin America, and I'm Latina, and I really resonated with that introduction when you spoke about your name being mispronounced growing up and being kind of having to just rethink of your identity and having to kind of fit in these norms in order to feel accepted. And so much of the process for you has been to recover your name and live into your identity. And I feel that even in my own upbringing, I moved to the States when I was 4 years old from Argentina. And I felt that pressure growing up. But it wasn't until now into adulthood that I'm learning to kind of put names to the things that I was experiencing growing up. Mm-hmm. And so I was just really moved by that introduction, especially because I felt seen and I felt heard. Mm-hmm. And even if we don't come from the same part of the world or our families do, there's shared experience there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I would just love to hear you explain a little bit more about why being accurately named is a significant spiritual concern.
I love that you connected with it, Mickey. Yeah. I agree. There's something I think about migration and, you know, generational and like, the experience of being a minority in the midst of all those things. Being named, you know, names are a big deal in scripture too, you know?
Yes, right.
There's so many ways that the names are significant. They mean things. People get their names changed, you know? Some Asian Americans, only have one name. Some Asian Americans have multiple names given, like for me, example, for me, my English name is Sabrina. My parents gave me a Chinese name, Si Wing. That's also my English middle name. And so there's this thing of having just multiple names. And I think, being named, you know, like when you're in a crowd and you're feeling really anonymous and you hear somebody say your name. It's such a nice, comforting and, you know, like a visceral feeling, you know, like, or, you know, that feeling when you're lost in a crowd and you're like, I don't know where my friends went. And then, you know, somebody says your name. It's like, oh. And I think for, as we were exploring this topic and thinking about it, like names, are really significant, partly because there can be so much connection, right? Whether that's the meaning or the hopes that parents put into names for their kids. And also there for Asian Americans and probably other communities, like you're describing, Mickey, the pain of not being named correctly or... Yeah. There's both pieces to that. And so, I think in the book, we're using name also as a broader thing of saying like, who are we? Right. And do people know our stories and can they, you know, there was this survey a few years ago, people like some ridiculous percentage of people could not name a famous Asian American. I think the biggest name was Bruce Lee and the next was Jackie Chan. And other than that, I think there was like, but some, I should go look up the statistic, but it was like a majority of people couldn't name. Which was sort of sad too, because, you know, our vice president is Asian American, Kamala Harris.
Right.
So, anyway, so there's this piece of, do people know me? And then also, does God know me? You know, I think growing up in the context I did and in the churches I did, I know there was a sense of like, God knows you. I mean, we, you know, we studied Psalm 139 and those kind of things.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I heard a pastor and a staff worker do a poem once at an Asian American conference, and it ended with, "And Jesus knows my Chinese name," and it opened something up in me because it just felt like, oh, Jesus knows me all the way, all the things, you know, all my communities, all my cultures, you know, like when I'm code switching between home and school, you know, church and school or whatever it is, like, Jesus knows all of that. That's a big deal.
Yeah, it is. And I feel like, you know, you mentioned before that you went to, you know, a white church, but then also the Chinese church. And so you're kind of hopping back and forth between the language and the just the differences in culture. And I think sometimes we lose our identity in that. I had the same experience. I grew up in the Hispanic Assemblies of God. So I went to church in Spanish. My faith community was all in Spanish, but then I would go to public school and everything was English. Mm-hmm. And then at some point we transitioned to, you know, a white evangelical church where everything was in English. And so the hopping back and forth too kind of makes you really think about your identity and sometimes question. And so that pressing, like, Jesus knows who I am fully and better than anyone, better than myself.
I think some of the theologians call that fragmentation when you can't, you know, bring all those different places. And so what does it look like to be integrated and be able to bring your whole self? Because we get used to sort of putting certain pieces, certain places.
Right. Know? Exactly.
So Sabrina, I was thinking when we were going to talk to you today that if you're my age, I'm in my late 60s now, which is hard to say, but just had a birthday, you know, so I have memories. My wife's mom is Japanese. So, and I lived in Southern California. So I have memories and drove by the internment camps and Seal Beach and stuff many, many times growing up. I had a brother who was killed in Vietnam. So I remember that Vietnamese era of prejudice, bias, racism, whatever. You know, China's occasionally in the news now is, you know, like our big enemy. I sometimes think you do realize we're talking about human beings, right? But if you just hear the word China in that sort of enemy way, you think of something disembodied that none of us even know anything about, and we don't actually have people in mind. Most recently, Sabrina, you know, 3 or 4 years ago when COVID was first coming out and there was all the debate about China and that lab and everything, I did have a few Asian American friends say to me that suddenly they're being cussed at in stores as they're trying to shop. And can you just say a bit about that as somebody who may have been on the receiving end of that, that would help our audience understand what it's like for that sort of thing to happen to you in modern America? Like, this isn't slavery 300 years ago. This is something that was 3 years ago.
It's interesting. I think for some of us who, I include myself in this, who grew up in places that weren't large Asian centers, you know, cities like New York, LA or San Francisco, Houston, you know, there are significant Asian American centers in those places, different communities, different backgrounds, different ethnicities, and many more cities now. But back in the day, when those of us who were growing up outside of those places, we actually experienced a lot of those same things growing up. So, you know, I've been told to go back to where I came from with much more choice words than that, you know, multiple times. You know, and different kinds of incidents like that. And you know, in the early 80s, when, you know, Japan was sort of the enemy, especially of auto workers, there's folks who were murdered because they were assumed to be Japanese. So in a sense, it's like that kind of violence has always been there. But with, you know, COVID and the statements that people were making, especially politicians, and just became much more revealed, maybe is how I would put it.
Okay.
I think all those things were there, have been there. And if you were in certain places, you knew it, but it was much more revealed. And I think for many Asian Americans, I don't know how widely this was reported in the mainstream news, but amongst the Asian American community, what was most hurtful were and are, the attacks on Asian elders. So I'm not sure how publicized that was, you know, in different communities around the country, and some of them in like the New Yorks and San Francisco, because there are large populations of Asian elders who are, you know, walking back and forth to their different activities, the grocery store or whatever. But people being attacked and beaten as elders, that I think was a very painful, painful thing. Yeah. And then after that, the Atlanta spa shootings that happened, I guess you could say murders. But that was also a pretty low point. But I remember hosting space. So I lead about, we have ministry to about 6,000 Asian American students across the country in InterVarsity. Mm-hmm. And there's about 230-ish staff who serve in all different ways. They don't all serve Asian American students, but, you know, from all different parts of the movement and on different campuses. And so we hosted a few spaces for lament and prayer and grief for just for staff, like only for staff. Yeah. And the pain was palpable as people shared about both current experiences they were having, but also how it tapped into previous experiences, you know, of having to try and defend their, you know, their mom as she's, you know, walking through a crowd or, you know, just different things. I think it was a time where those who hadn't maybe experienced that as much, or maybe were in denial about their previous experiences, you couldn't deny it anymore as an Asian American. Mm-hmm. And then I think for those outside the community, it was also revealing because it's like, oh, this is real. That was my sense, at least.
Yeah.
And we were writing this in the middle
of that.
We had actually started writing. We had actually put the proposal together fall 2018, spring 2019, gotten, you know, the contract and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And we kind of thought, oh, yeah, we'll write and it won't be too bad. I remember meeting in January 2020, we met up at a conference and we're going through our chapters. And mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, probably another 6 months, we'll be done.
Yeah.
And then the pandemic hit.
Right.
And, you know, three out of the four have young kids at home who are doing school online. And then all this is happening for Asian America. And we're like, oh,
in
my
real
goodness.
Time. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it did shape the book a little bit more. But honestly, I felt like, you know, especially my chapter on racialization, I felt like in some ways, I felt like, well, at least now I don't have to convince people as much.
Yeah.
Because before all that was more revealed, I think I felt like there's still some folks who feel like, oh, it's not so bad, you know, or like if we just keep our heads down and stay in line, like everything will be okay.
Hey, Alpha Mifflin Quokka is my name.
Saludos, my name is Jonathan Kinberg. And we want to together invite you to our second annual Diaspora Network Conference. Our theme this year is mutuality and mission. What does it look like for immigrants and the broader North American church to really partner together?
The conference will be on July 28th and 29th in Austin, Texas, and it's for immigrants and leaders from C4SO who want to partner with the nations here. See you soon.
One of your chapters is called Resisting Our Racialization. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit more about what it means in this context and why resisting is important?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, yeah, what I mean in that context is it's just in general how people are racialized. But that chapter, I'm particularly writing about Asian Americans. And so one of the main narratives for Asian Americans that is put on us, I would say, I guess there's two, perpetual foreigner, which means that no matter how long you've been in this country, you can still be seen as a foreigner, right? You can be fifth, sixth, seventh generation and be told to go back where you came from, which is like, what does that mean?
Right.
LA, you know?
Yeah.
And that's been, since Asian Americans first came, it's that perpetual foreigner, piece. And then that's coupled with model minority, which is the idea that it's the idea that Asian Americans are the minority that should be held up as a model, right? Mm. Compared to other minorities, quote unquote, because, you know, oh, you've made it so well. And like, y'all have these good jobs or, you know, these different things, without recognizing that some of that is really due to American immigration policy. So, you know, Asian Americans, Chinese Americans specifically, were excluded from 1882 and on until 1965, basically. And Asians in general were included in that for a lot of that time period. And then when they did start allowing, you know, folks to immigrate from Asia, it was all about whether you had the skills for the particular jobs that America needed at the time, right? And that's, you know, that's partly why we have so many Filipino nurses. That's why they let in a lot of scientists and engineers. Anyway, all that to say, I think the racialization is also that perpetual foreigner is something, you know, I don't want to be seen as foreign. I want to be included. And the escape hatch that's given, but as they would say in Star Wars, it's a trap, is the model minority, right? So if you just keep your head down, if you are useful, you know, in your job or whatever it is, and don't rock the boat, then we'll accept you on this conditional basis. And I think, you know, on a, as I was reflecting in the chapter and thinking about it, I think spiritually, yeah, there's certainly a resistance to the ways that the, in this way, I think sometimes Asian Americans as a community are used as a tool, you know what I mean? As a wedge, I guess, to be more specific, to divide, you know, and to sort of say like, oh, well, you know, racism isn't all that bad in our country because Asian Americans are doing okay. That's wrong on so many fronts, right? Asian Americans have the widest income disparity of any racial demographic. Like, it really ranges depending on if your family is from, like my family, for example. My parents came for graduate school, so they had more education. They didn't start with very much, but over time, I think we're able to, you know, because of the jobs they had, were able to save and, you know, grow their income. But, you know, many Asian Americans come over as refugees, you know, from Vietnam War or other situations, and there's not a lot, you know, and so there's a big gap. But yeah, I think the pieces of resistance are around, what does it mean to faithfully follow Jesus? And to acknowledge that these narratives are there, right? But how do we engage them both on an individual level and I think more importantly on a communal level? You know, I think scripture invites us to be far more communal than Western individualism would have, you know? And so what does that look like as we resist being used as a wedge? How do we learn from Latino sisters and brothers, our Black siblings, our Native communities? Like, what does it look like to look out? Not, I think the temptation of the American dream is for individual Asian American families to only look out for ourselves. Not to say that it's wrong to look out for each other, but I think God invites us to expand our definition of family and expand our definition of who our people are. And I say that as somebody who, like, you know, also wrestles with, right? Like, how do I want my kids to have a good education experience. And I know my parents came to try and give us a better life, but then what does that mean? How do I help us communally in that way?
So Sabrina, you and your co-authors tell diverse stories about the Asian diaspora in America and about how Asians of various kinds have been shaped and both misshaped by migration and culture and faith. When you look back now on the writing of that book and probably interacting with some readers since, what do you stands out as kind of the big theme of those diverse stories?
Yeah, we definitely wrestled with this a lot because our different communities and cultures have different histories in the United States. You know, La, she's writing from a Hmong background. Her parents were both refugees and that experience versus, you know, Linson growing up in Texas as an Indian American and David Filipino growing up in California. A lot of different experiences, but also all Asian American experiences, right? And so we really wrestled with how do we tell the particularities and also think about what brings us together? And some of that is the history, right? So being defined by exclusion, the ways that we have been sort of lumped in this category, it was initially by exclusion. But maybe some other big themes are being communal peoples. So, you know, all of us talked about family and how relationship and community are really significant driving factors. You know, that previous book was called Following Jesus Without Dishonoring Your Parents. And a lot of it wrestled with parents and kids and expectations and some of those things. Yeah. I think that's still all true. But I think in this book, we framed it more as it's because of the community and like the communal values that conflict is there with sometimes for communal parents and more individualist kids who've brought up in more individualistic culture, you know, and like, how do we navigate that? Religious diversity, I think, is another major theme, as, you know, Asian Americans are often in spaces that have a lot more diverse religions. Yeah. So that's a few of the things.
So, you know, as an Asian American, you, from everything that we've been reading in the book, is that there are multiple tensions in being an Asian American Christian, which, you know, I imagine leads in need to discover who one actually is and their identity in Christ and what God has in store for them and their communities. So why don't you tell us a little bit more, maybe just shed some more light on the tension between being an Asian American Christian and sort of the cultural implications of that?
Yeah, that's a great question, Mickey. You know, I think Law writes a great chapter on this, so I definitely point folks to that first and also to her, because she writes really well about Hmong culture and some of the religious practices and the way she's navigated that in her own life. I can speak more, a little bit more from Chinese American perspective and what I know about our, some of our practices in terms of, or maybe not practices, but just tensions, some of the tensions that are there. In Chinese culture and many East Asian cultures, there's a high regard for ancestors. And in some places that's called ancestor worship or ancestor veneration. And I think Chinese Christians and Chinese American Christians have had to figure out what do I participate in? What do I not? Like, how do I think about this? Right. And those are, and people have landed in different spaces, on that, you know, and in their discernment and in their sense of praying and asking God about it. And I think one of the things that has helped me in thinking about that, or at least having a broader framework, there's an author, Daniel Kikawa. He's, I think, ethnically Japanese, lives in Hawaii, and has done a lot of work, sort of in the vein of, I don't know if you would know, this is kind of older, but Don Richardson, he did all that work on Peace Child, I think, and how, you know, the story of Christ can be shared in different cultures and communities. Kikawa kind of takes that and also talks further about how, you know, some of the ways that Christian missionaries engaged other cultures, white Christian missionaries, I should say, engaged other cultures, you know, in that era, you know, the 1800s, early 1900s, and said, oh, all these practices are wrong. He argues that actually a lot of the ways, say, in the church that we celebrate, you know, Christmas trees and Easter eggs and some of these different things, they're not as, they've become Christian, shall we say, but they didn't start out that way. And so he's arguing for, you know, these traditions that we don't think anything of anymore. You know, even, you know, he has this long thing about weddings and Western weddings and some of the ways those traditions, you know. And it gave me a lot to think about, you know, in terms of, okay, so what culturally might some people think is like contrary to Christianity, but are there ways that we can be invited to bring things in that are, or you know, some people might say you're reappropriating, I don't know, but those are some of the things that I have thought about, you know, and I like to say, you know, big caveat that I haven't, you know, written a chapter on it or anything, but, and having worked with students who came to faith from different backgrounds who've asked, like, is it okay for me to go to temple, you know, to a Buddhist temple with my family? Like, what do you think? And we, you know, we talk about it, we prayed about it. We had to like, think about, well, what would it mean to your family if you didn't go? And in that particular situation, we sensed that it would be okay for her to go, like showing that she wanted to be part of the family was more important at that juncture than sort of trying to say like, oh, well, I can't participate in, you know, X, Y, Z. But those are really, yeah, live conversations. Yeah. I think that's also why it's so significant for Asian Americans who don't come from a Christian background or maybe come from another religious background mm-hmm. to choose into following Jesus. That's really significant because that's because we're so communal, because it right. means separating yeah. in a way mm-hmm. From family in some cases. Mm-hmm. That's a challenge.
Yeah, yeah, and that's, you know, that's why we wanted to ask that question is because we know we don't understand, but the complexities of these relationships is there. And choosing to follow Jesus means giving up, just giving up things that maybe made you who you were before, or it's costly to follow Jesus when you come from, you know, an Asian American background because of how, you know, what your parents might think or what your community will think. And so, yeah, just giving voice to that, I think gives a lot of enlightenment to those of us who are maybe on the outside looking in, but choosing Jesus can really be costly. And it seems as though community is important. And even in your Christian Asian American culture, in your community and the work that you do with InterVarsity, it sounds like you lean on one another for wisdom and discernment.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, I hope that, I don't mean to say like easier to follow Jesus in the sense that it's ever necessarily like, easy, but I hope that it would remove barriers, I guess, is what good. I would say. That you can, you know, that Christianity is not the white man's religion,
right?
And there's a way to, you asked earlier, Todd, about things we'd hope the book would do. Yeah. I realized towards the end of the writing process, I felt like, I hope this book can help catch some folks. I mean, I hope many things for the book, but one of the things I realized towards the end was I hope the book can help catch some folks who are maybe disillusioned with American Christianity, the way they've seen it. You know, if they grew up in a church that was more colorblind or just didn't realize that, you know, following Jesus involves all of who we are and not just this one spiritual part, you know. I hoped it could catch some folks who might want to like leave the whole thing, like leave the faith completely. Like I was like, oh, I hope this can help catch some people.
Yeah.
I do think for some Asian American Christians, the way some folks responded during, you know, that revealing of anti-Asian racism or have continued to respond is disillusioning. It's like, oh man.
Yeah.
These are the people who say they love Jesus.
Right.
That's hard.
Yeah.
So Sabrina, maybe one last question. What brings you hope right now, you know, in the wake of this book that has come out, the response, the work that you do with InterVarsity, what gives you hope right now for Asian American Christians and those who want to live with a deep commitment to Christ and what that looks like?
Yeah, that's a great question. I know I've talked a lot about some of the challenges and the harder things, but I think one response to the book has been really encouraging, both from Asian Americans and from those outside the community. We wrote with Asian Americans in mind, knowing that others we'd want to read also and get to know us better, right? Learning our names is both an us thing, like we are learning our names, and also an invitation to others to be learning our names. So response has been really encouraging, especially folks who are feeling like this, just the diversity of stories and different topics are in some ways a launching point for them, which is what we hoped, you know, that they could have deeper conversations and take things further. I think folks outside the community wanting to read the book have been encouraging, or folks like y'all having us on different podcasts and helping get the word out has been really encouraging. And I'm really excited for what this next generation of Asian American Christians, how God might continue to shape and disciple and grow them, and how God might use them in the future.
Yeah.
I feel like these days there's so much more opportunity for Asian American stories being told just in general in the media and in other places, on Instagram, you know, like TikTok. I'm not on TikTok, but all these different places. And I hope that for the church, I hope that the pieces, knowing that all our different communities, right, bring our experiences and our stories into following Jesus. And I'm looking forward to seeing more and more of our Asian American young people sharing these stories of hope, sharing their stories of challenge, but also of like what God's doing and what it might look like to continue resisting racialization, to engage different religious communities, to lean into the vocation that God's called them to. I think the, you know, around the country, I get to work with, you know, a lot of staff, a lot of student leaders, and their stories give me a lot of hope. I don't have time to tell you all those, but
maybe it's another book.
It's joy.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting. That'd be interesting.
Amen.
Well, Sabrina, thanks for being with us today. Thanks for being vulnerable. I know we asked you some vulnerable questions that cost you something to answer. And we in the audience are recipients of the generosity of your soul and heart and mind. We're grateful for it. We hope everybody will get Learning Our Names, Asian American Christians on Identity, Relationships, and Vocation. Thanks, Sabrina. Yeah.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yes, thank you so much. Thanks so much for tuning in to the C4SO podcast. If you like what you heard, please feel free to share this episode and subscribe and leave a review. It helps us to get the word out. Thanks.